Gerard Milburn is a professor of quantum physics at the University of Queensland in Australia. He is considered a pioneer in the fields of quantum noise, measurement, and control, and has published numerous works, including a book, Schrödinger's Machines, which explains quantum computing to a general audience. I got to talk to him recently about his research and his hopes for the future. Enjoy. I am here with Professor Gerard Milburn. Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
So I wanted to start off with a very basic question for the popular audience. What is, just to establish what we're talking about here, what is a quantum computer?
Right. A quantum computer is a machine that uses quantum principles to implement basic operations. So in a classical computer, basic operations are implemented by switches, and the behavior of those switches is determined by classical mechanics, including the classical theory of electricity and magnetism. A quantum computer replaces those sorts of switches with devices that satisfy the laws of quantum mechanics. So that's the first issue. Now, you might have thought, well, I do that if you're just going to implement a standard transistor, but in a quantum system. But the key point is a quantum switch, unlike a classical switch, can be in a superposition of two distinct states, on or off, which could encode logical one and logical zero.
I see. So in other words, instead of the fundamental unit of information just being a bit, a one or a zero, it's a quantum bit, a qubit, and you can...
That's exactly right. So that's a qubit. However, there is a catch, and that is while you can process information with a quantum qubit, when you come to read it out, you only get one bit of information. So the key in using a quantum switch is to find problems that can exploit the ability of a switch to be in a superposition of both on and off, so that when you do finally read it out and get one bit, you get access to a better or more efficient form of computation.
And how did you get involved in quantum computing?
Ah, well, that's I've been involved in quantum computing since the mid-1980s. And one day I happened to come across the very famous paper by Richard Feynman on pointing out that there are some problems in quantum physics that classical computers will never be able to solve efficiently. And so then why not build a quantum device to solve quantum problems? About the same time, I came across Ed Fredkin's paper on reversible computation and Rolf Landauer's papers on what is the minimal energy cost in order to implement a switch. And this started me thinking about how to implement quantum switches using optics, using single photons of light. And so my first paper on this was in 1989, where I proposed a quantum switch using single photons passing through a nonlinear optical device. Needless to say, it was highly impractical at the time, but not so impractical now. So it started very early with my interest in the reversibility or irreversibility of computation.
One of the things that you just mentioned about how there are certain problems that a classical computer could never solve efficiently, that's one of the things that's very exciting about quantum computers, is that they can take potentially an entirely new class of problems, the non-polynomial or NP problems that are exponentially difficult to solve on a classical computer. And a quantum computer, we believe, can solve them in a reasonable amount of time. What is it about quantum computers that makes them able to do that? And why is that important?
Okay, well, it's important to understand that many of these complexity claims believed to be true, although proofs are slow in coming. It's certainly true that factoring is a non-polynomial problem on a classical computer, and on a quantum computer, it is what's called bounded error polynomial. It's probabilistic, but with high probability, it produces the right result. So your question was, what is it about a quantum computer that enables a quantum bit of hardware to do something that a classical bit of hardware cannot? Now, there are many answers to this. Perhaps the simplest one is to focus on the problem of finding the prime factors of large integers. One of the key steps in the mathematical algorithm for solving that problem is to find the period of a function. So by this, I mean that when you evaluate the function on its possible input, let's suppose they're the integers, after some very large integer, it will begin to repeat. So it might be equal to 1 on 1 and then come back to 1 when it's evaluated on an input of, say, 9 or 10. Now, finding the period requires you to run through many, many independent evaluations of the function, many, many independent function calls. And if the period is really big, that is, in the integer case, you have to evaluate thousands and thousands of calls of the function to find the period, that's not very efficient. And of course, you don't really care what the value of the function is on each input. You really only want to know what is the period, which is a property of the function. And that's exactly the sort of problem that a quantum algorithm works well on. That is, when you don't so much care what the value of the function is on each input, but only want to know some global property of the function, such as its period. So the way the quantum algorithm for that works is by giving a superposition of all possible input values to the function, not reading out the value on each one, but continuing to process the device so that the desired property of the function, that is its period, can be determined with high probability. And that's why quantum computers are good at finding periods of functions, and that leads them to enable good, efficient algorithms for factoring large integers. In principle, nobody's done it yet, but except for very small integers, of course.
So based on what you're saying, if I understand you correctly, with the special case of factoring a number, what a quantum computer can do is it no longer has to iterate manually through a series of function calls. Rather, it can sort of look at the whole all at once. Is that correct in saying?
That's indeed correct. So the information that you want to extract is not the value of the function on every input, but a much smaller amount of information, which is the period of the function. And the quantum computer enables you to do that by evaluating all the inputs simultaneously.
One of the things I wanted to ask you is, do you see any dangers with quantum computers in terms of what sorts of new capabilities they might bring about and how bad actors might exploit them?
Of course, any new technology can, or in fact, any technology can be exploited by bad actors if they're sufficiently motivated. And I'm sure quantum technologies, of which quantum computing is one, will be no different. But I don't see that there'll be any significant change in the capabilities, if you like, of bad actors once they have quantum computers in their hand. There's this...
Go ahead.
Of course, one of the main things that got quantum computing going 20-odd years ago was the discovery that they would enable factorization of large integers, which would break public key encryption currently in used in most communication protocols over the internet. However, this is not a serious problem because we know that there are new encryption algorithms that can't be broken by a quantum computer. Obviously, it'd be very inconvenient to have to change the implementation of encryption on the entire internet, but it certainly isn't in principle difficulty. So I don't think bad actors could achieve anything particularly horrendous by using quantum computers to break encryption.
Okay, so that's because that was the line of questioning I wanted to go down was about encryption, because I think I mentioned to you in my email, I did a very small bit of undergrad research in quantum computing, and my professor, who was really in charge of it all, mentioned early on that governments are in some ways looking at quantum computers as almost a cyber nuclear bomb, in the sense that, you know, whoever gets there first can break the encryption of other governments around the world if they don't have the same capabilities. Do you share that view at all, or do you think that's sort of an exaggeration?
I think that's an exaggeration, because, as I said, we know that there are encryption protocols that can't be beaten by a quantum computer. And so at any point, we could switch over to those long before a practical quantum computer comes along. And it should be mentioned that to break current encryption on the internet using a quantum computer would require a machine with millions and millions of qubits. And we're nowhere near that technologically at the moment.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about your current research interests. You mentioned quantum machine learning. Could you describe what that is? What sorts of problems are folks in that area working on right now?
Okay, so there are two aspects to this. And to explain what they are, it's as well to mention that there are two approaches to quantum computing in general. One is based on what you might call a universal digital quantum computer that is sufficiently flexible that any problem can be programmed into it and solved. But there's another kind of quantum computer, which is called a simulator, where you essentially hardwire a particular problem into the machine, and that will give you greater efficiency on that particular problem. And that problem may be very interesting. It may be some complex optimization problem in machine learning. Also, those sorts of simulators tend to require less overheads in terms of error correction. In fact, errors and noise can probably work to your advantage to some extent. So with those two points in mind, it's more of the simulator, I think, that has applications in quantum machine learning. And one of the things I'm particularly interested in at the moment is using essentially irreversible quantum simulators to get an enhanced performance. It's generally thought that for quantum computers, you need to get rid of irreversibility. You somehow or other need to make the device operate in a completely reversible fashion so that there's no friction or no heat or no decoherence. But in actual fact, that is unnecessary. Quantum tunneling can be reversible, but it's often irreversible. The standard example is nuclear decay, which is certainly not thermally activated, but the alpha particle tunnels out of the nucleus and it never comes back. It's the very definition of irreversibility. And so there's a class of quantum analog machines that one could build that exploit that kind of irreversibility to achieve enhancement, particularly in the applications of machine learning.
If I could ask you about machine learning in general.
Yes.
I have... A lot of my friends, including friends who are very technical, seem to have very outsized expectations of what sorts of problems machine learning will solve in the near future. Do you ever find yourself sort of rolling your eyes about the popular discourse around AI, or do you think that predictions of a singularity are actually founded?
Well, it's certainly true that there are some considerable exaggerations beyond our current technical capability. I think we're a very long way from the singularity. One of the things that I suppose machine learning raises questions about is the veracity of what it's actually doing. Unlike an ordinary algorithmic computer where you can sit down and analyze the program and the algorithm that's been implemented in the device to understand why and how it solves the problem, or if it fails to solve it, why it fails. But in a deep learning architecture, it's sometimes utterly opaque how the machine has delivered an answer. Fine, you can train it on a data set where you know what it should do, but then you have to go off, obviously, and use it in situations where you don't know what it's going to do. That's the whole point. And so it tends to look a little bit oracular at times. It delivers a result, and verifying or coming to some understanding or explanation of what it's done is not easy. There are many new techniques that people are developing to get around this problem, but it's still a fundamental philosophical distinction between an algorithmic computer and a machine learning computer, is the ability to interrogate the machine and ask, how did it arrive at this particular? So that's a little worrying.
Worrying in what sense?
Well, you know, if an expert, a human expert, applying their human intelligence, reaches some judgment in a complex situation, we will ask them to please explain. And they will come up with some narrative to explain how they reached a particular judgment. And that's fine for humans. You can then interrogate them further and decide whether or not that's a valid explanation, or whether there's some assumptions there that you feel are unjustified. But you can't ask a deep learning network to please explain what it's done in quite the same way. It's not going to produce some meta-narrative, at least at the moment, explaining how it reached a particular judgment, how it decided that this particular image is a cancerous melanoma and not a benign melanoma. Sure, you can pass it off to experts to double check, but the whole point of using the machine in the first place was to avoid the need for expensive experts in every situation. So it's in that sense that I mean that asking a machine learning or deep learning network to justify its results is a difficult problem.
I see. One of the other questions I wanted to ask you on that area is, I've heard people like Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg use a term, general intelligence, that is supposed to be a goal of AI researchers, they claim, and general intelligence meaning basically a computer that can perform any intelligent task that a human could. Is that term something that exists among the research scientists? Is that a goal that you all are striving towards?
Well, that's difficult for me to answer. I should stress that I'm not a machine learning expert. I'm a quantum physicist interested in building quantum devices. But let me try and say something. First of all, I think it's very unlikely that without having an embodied machine, a machine that can act in the world, that is, has actuators that can change its environment, and that has sensors that can respond to those changes, I think without that capability, it's very unlikely we'll build a machine with general intelligence. So we're in the question now, this is sort of the domain of robotics. And I think simple problems, we will be able to build complex actuators and complex sensors to solve, such as navigating around a complex environment, interacting with other machines similarly endowed, and so on. But the class of problems that fall into general intelligence is so wide and varied that it's hard to know yet exactly what an embodied intelligent machine is capable of. In fact, in that sense, there is a role for quantum mechanics, which is beyond quantum computing. And that is, if you're going to build actuators and sensors, you need to assume something about the sorts of physical environment in which they're going to work. And we know that there are some situations where you need to use quantum measurement scenarios in order to extract if that's high quality, not corrupted by noise. So one of the things I'm particularly interested in is embodied AI devices that use quantum actuators and quantum sensors to experience quite different physical environments to anything that we would ourselves normally experience. A quantum actuator could be as simple as a single photon pulse, which is a highly non-classical state of the electromagnetic field. And indeed, a time sequence of single photon pulses could become entangled. It's called time bin entanglement. And this kind of quantum actuator probes very different states of the physical world. And then we can come up with quantum detection protocols based on something called Hongu and Mandel interference to extract that information efficiently. So one of the overlooked aspects of quantum machine intelligence is the ability of a quantum embodied agent to use quantum actuators and quantum sensors to experience the world very differently to the one that we ourselves experience.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned that you're doing work now in quantum artificial agents. Could you tell us a little bit about what those are?
Yes. Well, it's related to what I just said. So one of the big problems I've been interested in a long time is, where does our concept of causation arise? And it was a very old subject, of course. It goes back to philosophers like Hume. And it's kind of odd, because in fundamental physics, as Russell pointed out, there is no role for causation. We have equations of motion, and if we have the initial conditions, we can solve for all future states and indeed all past states without any difficulty. There's no asymmetry. There's no built-in irreversibility between cause and effect. So the argument has to move somewhere else. And to me, it moves to the central notion of a causal machine, one which can interact with its environment through actuators and experience those changes in the environment through sensors. Now, if such a machine can store records of all its actions and all its sensations, it can begin to develop an understanding of the correlations between its actions and its subsequent sensations. And it's in those correlations that the notion of causation arises. So it's entirely perspectival. It's entirely from the internal perspective of that machine with access to its internal memory records that we think causation will be grounded. From the outside, such a machine just looks like yet another far from equilibrium system interacting with its environment. So if we average out all those records, make them inaccessible, we would use a completely different description of how that world interacts with its environment, essentially a thermodynamic description. But from the internal perspective of the machine, it makes its only real way of understanding what it's doing, perhaps understandings somewhat begs the question, but the algorithm that it will use to exploit those records will necessarily embody some notion of cause and effect. In essence, what the machine is doing is signaling itself from actuators to sensors via a channel that runs through the external world. So they're the sort of artificial agents I'm particularly interested in, ones that are sufficiently sophisticated that they can be described as causal machines.
I see. When you mention the role of perspective,
yes.
When people talk about downloading a consciousness to a machine, like something like Elon Musk is proposing with Neuralink, do you see that as being a meaningful idea, I suppose the experience of being a robot would be just a different experience than being a conscious human being. Are these long-term goals that make sense to you or no?
No, not really. Okay. Well, first of all, there's a fairly limited understanding of what consciousness actually is, let alone what it's good for. And it's unclear to me whether we'd ever want a machine to embody it. However, that remains to be seen. But there's a lot of research done on neural correlates of consciousness, global activation of neural circuits right across the cortex after some 300 millisecond timescale seem to be a pretty clear indicator of conscious awareness. But there's so much else going on in the human brain, most of which you wouldn't even think of describing in computational terms. It's more like a gigantic feedback system to maintain the body in some optimal state, far from equilibrium. And it's not clear whether thinking of that in computational sense would be relevant, and therefore not clear how you would ever download that into some sort of machine. But you raise an interesting question, machine intelligence. And at some point, this opaqueness that seems to characterize deep learning networks may come to characterize sufficiently advanced AI in general. And it may never be open to us to interpret it as a conscious machine in the way we interpret each other as a conscious agent. It may literally be an utterly alien intelligence. Clearly, it will have to communicate with us in some way, but this opaqueness as to what's going on in its head, so to speak, will be magnified many, many times beyond what the problem is for current machine learning networks.
Wow. I wanted to jump back real quick to something we had briefly talked about earlier, which was the belief among some people in the quantum computing world that quantum computers developed in the future could potentially take any NP problem, a non-polynomial exponentially hard problem, and solve it in a reasonable amount of time, unlike a classical computer. You said you mentioned that the proofs of that have not been forthcoming yet. Is that seems like it would be a major game changer if quantum computers could solve that class of problems efficiently?
Yeah. So I think it's just going to be a question of ingenuity and coming up with different kinds of NP problems that a quantum computer can solve within its class of BQP, bounded error probabilistic models. It's hard to know. There'll be clever people trying very hard. But this is for an exponential speed up. And in fact, you know, that's not always, clearly an exponential speed up greatly improves the efficiency of the machine, but sometimes you don't need an exponential speed up. And there are many problems where a square root speed up can be achieved on a quantum computer. And, you know, if you're doing financial trading and need some difficult optimization problem that on the current computer takes 9 days to solve, but on a quantum device will take 3 days to solve, the company that has that device is going to win big. So while in the theoretical sense, exponential speed up is great for technology and implementations and industry, you don't need an exponential speed up to dramatically increase your profits.
I see. Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's really all.
Oh,
I have
okay.
To say. Now, of course, the really, really big problem is whether, as far as we know, quantum computers cannot solve NP complete problems with an exponential speed up. Of course, a quantum computer can solve exactly the same class of problems that a classical computer can solve, so-called Turing computability. Now, the real question that we're talking about here is efficiency. And if someone was able to prove that a quantum device could solve NP-complete problems, this would be an absolute catastrophe for our understanding of mathematics and physics, because we know so many things that would go wrong if that complexity hierarchy collapsed. Or at least we think we know. These are highly speculative branches of physics and theoretical computer science.
You mean,
so,
in other words, sorry, go ahead.
So if we were able to show that quantum computers can solve NP complete problems, then it would require very strange physics beyond what we have today, causes problems with superluminal communication and other difficulties which people have highlighted, particularly Scott Aronson, a quantum computer scientist, has identified some of these problems.
So in other words, right now, because so many, other aspects of math and computer science are dependent on the fact that P does not equal NP, that there are NP-complete problems, no matter what kind of computer can solve them efficiently. Because yep. so much of the rest of science depends on that notion, it would be a bad thing, actually, if quantum computers could do
that. That's right. These are obscure connections, which I'm not sure anybody understands. This curious connection between physics as we understand it and complexity classes of computation. It's a very curious connection. But it's sufficiently strong now that we really would have to worry that any claim to solve P equals NP using a quantum computer, you would really have to worry about the veracity of such a claim. It would be a little bit like saying you could build a perpetual motion machine and violate the laws of thermodynamics.
I see. One of the big important effect of the classical computer revolution was the new capabilities that researchers could use to solve previously unsolved problems, like the four-color problem. It was a classic unsolved problem for mathematics, and it wound up, the proof was written by a computer. Do you see quantum computers as being capable of solving previously intractable problems or being used for those kind of purposes?
Certainly they'll be used to solve previously intractable problems in physics. So the kind of analog simulated quantum computer I was discussing earlier is what D-Wave has built. And those devices can, in principle, solve problems of great practical import that we could never do on a conventional computer in any sensible timeline. So, yeah, sure, they'll be used in drug design and better materials design and all sorts of problems in scheduling, in business and finance. But whether they'll be used to prove theorems, that I don't know. Or at least used to prove theorems any better than a conventional computer can use to prove theorems. That I don't know.
Okay. What do you see as being if you were 100 years from now, what do you think the history of quantum computing would look like at that point?
So this is looking into the crystal ball. So this is obviously I have to give a few caveats here.
Right, speculation, sure.
Sure, speculation. Well, I have a hunch that what we will see, we will almost in 100 years certainly see these digital error-corrected qubit universal quantum computers or something pretty much like them. But I think sitting alongside them and perhaps just as powerful, if not more powerful, will be the full realization of analog quantum computation. In fact, if you look at the history of ordinary classical computation, it's rather curious. Around about the time von Neumann came up with his model of a computer, of computation, there was a lot of work going on analog computation. It formed part of the foundations of the field of cybernetics with Norbert Wiener and others, and von Neumann was very much a part of that. But analog computers were used to solve lots of very important problems, particularly in military and defense applications. But they were generally regarded as special purpose computers. On the other hand, there are math theorems that tell you that the class of computable functions, there's a kind of universality for functions that satisfy certain complex differential equations. And so an analog device that solves a sufficiently complicated set of differential equations might have enormous capability. And so what I expect to see sometime, probably, well, less than 100 in the next two or three decades, is extremely powerful analog-like quantum computers that simulate very complex physical systems, and perhaps not even physical systems, perhaps very complex mathematical systems, very sophisticated systems of differential equations that we really have no access to at the moment. And that's machine learning. We can't neglect that. I'm pretty sure there's no doubt whatsoever that quantum devices will form an integral part of future machine learning systems. Not necessarily fully quantum, but having quantum aspects to their operation. I think there's no doubt about that.
Okay. Sorry, go ahead.
Nope, that was all I
had. That was it. Okay. One of the questions I wanted to ask was, do you think in the future there will always be room for classical computers? I mean, if quantum computers get to a point where they're cheap and easy to produce and they can do all the things that a classical computer can do, why have any classical computers around?
Yes, indeed. Why would you? Except the interface will need to be classical if we're going to communicate with it. But yes, inside the machine, beyond its interface, yeah, it could be fully quantum. Most users wouldn't know what's inside their current computer. It could, might as well be quantum as classical, so long as it behaves well, as far as they're concerned, and solves the problems they need solved. Bye.
It seems like, and I don't want to take up too much of your time, so this will be last question.
No problem.
Okay. It seems like since quantum computers require, if studying computer science, I know it's virtually impossible to keep every aspect of even a classical computer in your mind at one time and to fully understand, on a level of the processor, the operating system, the physics of it. But for quantum computers, it seems like it's just a new degree of complexity. Do you see quantum computers sort of hastening the specialization of the sciences? Do you think that's a good thing, or will it provide new opportunities for interdisciplinary study?
Yes. I don't think it will hasten the specialization. I think quantum computing should be seen as one aspect of a whole raft of emerging quantum technologies that solve problems using quantum physics. And so what will happen is there'll be new departments of quantum engineering. They are already beginning to pop up around the world. And of course, once you build a few quantum technologies, you can build on the back of that new technologies and new capabilities that you haven't had before. So it begins to bootstrap itself. But in terms of opportunities, yes, I think there'll be a wealth of opportunities for quantum engineers in the future who will have the skills required to use quantum mechanics in a technical setting. And of course, they'll reach the point where they don't need to understand in detail everything that happens inside a quantum computer, but they will have the design tools and the engineering tools and the analytic tools to enable them to build those devices and to fix them when they break. So I'd say the biggest opportunity at the moment is in quantum technology more generally, not just quantum computing. There's some really big opportunities out there for better clocks, better sensors, better communication protocols, better imaging protocols, that will have an immediate effect on advanced economies in the world today.
Well, since I'll cheat a little bit and I'll ask one more question then. Okay. In that case, what about quantum computers or just quantum technology in general are you most excited about looking in the future?
Right. Well, for the last 10 years, I've been directing a large center for engineered quantum systems here in Australia. And one of the things we're most excited about there is quantum sensors. For example, one of my colleagues, Warwick Bowen, has developed protocols, or machines rather, highly experimental devices that can enable much greater sensitivity of magnetic fields in very small devices. And so these things would have application in many fields where you need to detect weak magnetic fields. For example, there's a technology that uses the ability to take weak magnetic fields to do brain imaging, imaging of neural processes happening in our brain. But they're, you know, messy, complicated devices that often require low temperature. But quantum devices using quantum sensors could exceed the performance of those things. They're not there yet, and would need a considerable engineering development to compete with current devices. But the motivation is there. So quantum sensors, I think, have a huge role to play. After all, one of the key things that enabled the rise of smartphones was to put sensors into them, GPS sensors and inertial sensors and clocks and so on. So anything that improves those sensors gives you a new capability and new things you can do.
Well, I think that it's a fascinating topic. I'm always curious to see what's coming down the pipeline in terms of the immediate future, but also, you know, over the scope of the century. So this was a really good discussion. Gerard Milburn, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Duncan. Okay. Happy to be here.
Thank you to Gerard Milburn, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. See you next time.